Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from VOA Learning English. And welcome to the Sunday edition of As It Is, the free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's January 31st, 2016. It was on this day in 1968 that attacks began on the United States Embassy in Saigon and other areas of South Vietnam. The attacks became known as the Tet Offensive. And on this day in 2010, Avatar became the first film to sell more than $2 billion in tickets worldwide. Today on the program, we will tell you what happened when a company that was unhappy about an online review sued the person who posted it. And as we always do on Sundays, we will present words and their stories. This week, we will tell you about the word blizzard. Recently, Washington, D.C. was shut down by a powerful storm that dropped a lot of snow on the nation's capital. We call such a storm a blizzard. Today, we'll tell you how to tell your friends about a blizzard in everyday American English. And finally on the program, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week, we continue the story of Theodore Roosevelt. He became president at the beginning of the 20th century, a time of great technological progress in the United States. And we'll also tell you how you can get a free copy of the 2016 VOA calendar mailed to you. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English. Because we exist to help you learn everyday American English, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. What happens when a company doesn't like a review that a customer wrote online and takes legal action against them? Mario Ritter tells us.
In 2009, John and Jen Palmer posted a critical online comment about a business. The Palmers said they ordered and paid for a small toy and a keychain for $20 from cleargear.com, but never got the items. They said they could never reach anyone at Clear Gear to fix the problem. They posted their complaint on ripoffreport.com. 3 years later, Jen Palmer said her husband received an email from Clear Gear demanding they remove the post. If not, he was told he would have to pay a $3,500 fine. Clear Gear said the Palmers violated the company's policy that bars customers from posting critical comments. It is becoming common practice for businesses to demand money from customers who criticize them online, according to Eric Goldman, a Santa Clara University law professor. He follows internet legal issues. These do not criticize clauses come as review sites such as Yelp, TripAdvisor, Angie's List, and ZocDoc become more popular. ComScore, an online research company, lists Yelp and TripAdvisor among the top 50 websites in the U.S. The sites have more visitors than even Netflix and ESPN. Jen Palmer said she and her husband tried to remove their critical post, but could not get Ripoff Report to take it down. They refused to pay the $3,500 fine demanded by Clear Gear. They said they did not believe the company had the right to demand it. 2 years later, a judge agreed with them. He said the company was wrong to demand money and to report the couple's refusal to pay to a credit rating agency. That hurt the Palmers' credit rating and made it impossible for them to finance the purchase of a furnace and car, Jen Palmer said. The judge awarded the couple over $300,000 in damages. At a recent Senate hearing, consumer advocates said what happened to the Palmers is not unusual. They gave some examples. A New York City inn fined newlyweds $500 for every critical review posted by them or their wedding guests. A dentist demanded $100 a day from a patient for each day he kept an online posting accusing the dentist of overcharging him. The U.S. owner of a Paris rental apartment barred renters from using blogs or websites for complaints. In all three cases, the business owner either backed down or was ordered to stop by a court. But Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, said the public will never know how many critical online postings get taken down under pressure. Most people, he said, would rather avoid the threat of excessive penalties, costly litigation, or damage to their credit scores. Since that November Senate hearing, the Senate passed Thune's bill to stop companies from blocking critical online comments. The bill is now pending in the House of Representatives. The U.S. Constitution guarantees free speech. But backers of the Thune legislation say the guarantee applies mostly to government, not private businesses. The First Amendment Center notes that the Supreme Court has said that private organizations can limit free speech on their property. Some business groups complain that some online reviewers make up problems. One hotel owner wrote that a customer who described his hotel as filthy did not even stay there. TripAdvisor has responded to such criticism. The website said it allows businesses to respond to every review, positive or negative. And most hotels get many reviews, making it hard for a single very negative or very positive review to have much effect, TripAdvisor said. I'm Mario Ritter.
Now, as we do every Sunday, we present Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. People everywhere like to talk about the weather. Ana Mateo is here to tell us about expressions that come from extreme winter weather.
Winters in the northern United States are cold and snowy. Sometimes the snows come with extremely strong winds. These snowstorms are called blizzards. It is difficult to see through the fast-blowing snow of a blizzard, so they are often described as blinding. The dictionary Etymology Online says, blizzard came to mean a severe snowstorm during the late 1800s. Before then, the word blizzard had nothing to do with snow. It had several other meanings. One was a sharp blow, like hitting a ball with a stick. Another meaning was a gunshot. And blizzard was also defined as a most extreme statement or event. These days, we do not use blizzard to mean any of those things. Blizzard is only used to mean an extreme snowstorm. The first such use was in 1870. An especially violent and heavy snowstorm struck the state of Iowa. The storm was the worst winter storm in a long time. A newspaper editor in a small Iowa town called the terrible storm a blizzard. Much like a blizzard, the use of the word blew across the country over the next few years. Just as snow sticks to the ground, the word blizzard stuck as meaning any really bad winter storm. Snow changes the world around us. When snow is falling, the world seems somehow soft, peaceful, and quiet. But blizzards are different. They can be dangerous. Blizzards create whiteout conditions. A whiteout is when snow is falling fast and winds drive the snow so much that it is impossible to see. Driving a vehicle in driving snow can be deadly. Cities sometimes declare a temporary state of emergency. This tells people to stay off the roads. This prevents accidents and also lets the snow removal trucks do their work. Deep, heavy snow is difficult to move. Clearing snow from roads and sidewalks is hard work. During a blizzard, people often get snowed in. They cannot leave their houses because snowdrifts block doorways. To make matters worse, high winds and heavy snow can break limbs off trees. These limbs often hit power lines, cutting power and sometimes heat to homes and businesses. People who stock up on food and supplies are better prepared to deal with a blizzard. They hunker down or remain in their homes for many days. Often before a blizzard, people panic shop. Stores see a run on things like bread, milk, eggs, and toilet paper, all classic blizzard supplies. Even though blizzards can be dangerous, some people still enjoy the excitement caused by this extreme weather. But no one likes to be snowed. Snow as a verb means to tell someone many pleasant but false statements. This action is also called a snow job. If someone tries to snow you, you could say they are being cold, meaning their actions are rough, mean, or unfeeling. Blizzards may be hard to see through, but if you are smart, snow jobs are not. For example, if someone tells you that you can learn English without working hard, they are trying to snow you. But listening to VOA Learning English is a good way to help your English studies. And that is no snow job. I'm Anna Mateo.
There's a blizzard coming on. How I'm wishing I was home. For my pony's lame and he can't hardly stand.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present our popular weekly program, The Making of a Nation. This week, we continue the story of the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. Many Americans know him as Teddy Roosevelt. He became president of the United States at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of great technological progress in the United States. Yet many people felt that there was too little social progress. They demanded reforms in politics, industry, and the use of natural resources. President Roosevelt supported this call for reforms. His first target was big business. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe are here to tell us more about the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt.
In the early 1900s, a group of wealthy American businessmen agreed to join their railroads. They formed a company or trust to control the joint railroad. The new company would have complete control of rail transportation in the American West. There would be no competition. President Roosevelt believed the new company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. Roosevelt said he would make no compromises in enforcing the law. He asked the Supreme Court to break up the railroad trust. "We are not," Roosevelt said, "attacking these big companies. We are only trying to do away with any evil in them. We are not hostile to them, but we believe they must be controlled to serve the public good."
The Supreme Court ruled against the railroad trust. In the next few years, other trusts would be broken up in the same way. The American people called this trust busting, and they called Theodore Roosevelt the trust buster. Roosevelt made several speeches explaining his position on big business. Everywhere he went, he found wide public support. Later, he told a friend why people liked him so well. He said, "I put into words what is in their hearts and minds, but not in their mouths."
President Roosevelt won even more public support for his actions during a labor crisis in the coal industry. The incident was one of many in American history in which a president had to decide if he should interfere in private industry. Coal miners went on strike in the spring of 1902. They demanded more pay and safer working conditions. Mine owners refused to negotiate. One even insulted the miners. He said the rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for. it will not be the labor activists who take care of him. It will be the Christian men to whom God, in his great wisdom, has given the control of the property interests of this country. This self-serving use of religion made many Americans support the striking workers.
After several months, President Roosevelt invited coal mine owners and union leaders to a meeting in Washington. He asked them to keep in mind that a third group was involved in their dispute, the public. He warned that the nation faced the possibility of a winter without heating fuel. Roosevelt said, "I did not call this meeting to discuss your claims and positions. I called it to appeal to your love of country." The union leaders said they were willing to have the president appoint an independent committee to settle the strike. They said they would accept the committee's decision as final. The mine owners rejected the idea. One warned the president not even to talk about it. Such talk, he said, was illegal interference in private industry.
That made Theodore Roosevelt angry. Later, he said, "If it were not for the high office I held, I would have taken him by the seat of the pants and the nape of the neck and thrown him out the window." Finally, Roosevelt got both sides to agree to a compromise. Mine owners agreed to have an independent committee study the miners' demands, and the miners agreed to return to work until the study was completed. Several months later, the report was ready. The committee proposed that miners accept a smaller pay increase in exchange for improved working conditions. Both sides accepted the proposal. The coal strike ended.
Not everyone was happy. Many people still felt Roosevelt had no right to interfere. Roosevelt disagreed. "My business," he said, "is to see fair play among all men, capitalists or wage workers. All I want to do is see that every man has a fair deal, no more, no less." Roosevelt believed the United States needed a strong leader. He planned to strengthen the presidency whenever he could. Roosevelt was an active, noisy man. As one writer described him, "Theodore is always the center of action. When he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to a funeral, he wants to be the dead man." Many of Roosevelt's friends thought he was an overgrown boy. "You must always remember," one said, "that the president is about 6 years old." Another friend sent this message to Roosevelt on his 46th birthday: "You have made a very good start in life. We have great hopes for you when you grow up."
Theodore Roosevelt loved outdoor activities. He especially loved the natural beauty of the land. He worried about its future. Roosevelt wrote, "I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use the natural riches of our land. But I do not recognize the right to waste them, nor to rob, by wasteful use, the generations that come after us." Roosevelt set aside large areas of forest land for national use. He created 50 special areas to protect wildlife, and he established a number of national parks.
Theodore Roosevelt faced the responsibilities of foreign policy with the same strength he used in facing national problems. He firmly believed in expanding American power in the world. "We have no choice," he said, "as to whether or not we will play a great part in the world. All that we can decide is whether we will play our part well or poorly." To play well, Roosevelt said, the United States needed a strong navy. It also needed a canal across Central America so the navy could sail quickly between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
For many years, people had dreamed of such a waterway. With a canal across Central America, ships could sail directly from ocean to ocean. They would not have to make the long, costly voyage around the southern end of South America. The most likely place to build such a canal was at the thinnest point of land, Panama. Another possible place was just to the north, Nicaragua. Over the years, several attempts were made to build the canal.
In the 1880s, Ferdinand de Lesseps, builder of the Suez Canal, formed a French company to build a waterway across Panama. De Lesseps spent $300 million to build just one-third of the canal. He could get no more money. His company failed. In the 1890s, an American company tried to build a canal across Nicaragua. It made little progress. After 3 years, it gave up the attempt. When Theodore Roosevelt became president in the early 1900s, he was ready to try again.
A study was made to decide which would be a better place for the canal, Panama or Nicaragua. Engineers said it would cost less to complete the canal de Lesseps had started 20 years earlier in Panama. But de Lesseps' company still owned the land on which the canal would be built. The United States would have to buy the land, as well as the rights to build the waterway. The study decided it would be less costly to build the canal in Nicaragua. The proposal went to the United States Congress for approval. That will be our story next week here on the Sunday edition of As It Is. This Making of a Nation was written by Frank Beardsley. It was presented by Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe, and we thank them all. Now, we want to tell you how you can get a free copy of the 2016 VOA calendar. It's simple. Just ask. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. And be sure to include your mailing address when you write, and please tell us where you heard this program, the radio station you heard it on, and the time of the broadcast, or whether you listened to it on a podcast. Well, that's As It Is, the Sunday edition. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz reporting.